Today we welcome Elizabeth Jane Corbett, author of the historical fiction novel The Tides Between, a CBCA notable for 2018. A story set in 1841 about immigration to Australia and the harrowing journey they took to arrive on Australian shores. It's also a story about the importance of storytelling, focusing on Welsh tales and legends. If you enjoy the podcast, please check out our back catalogue of incredible authors, including Jackie French, Kate Forsyth, Longmire's Craig Johnson, Will Costakis, Gabrielle Tozer, Rusty Young, and many more. I'm your host, Danny V.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Joining us on the podcast today. I'm really excited to talk to you because I really enjoyed The Tides Between.
Thank you.
The novel, it was such a pleasant surprise for me. I hadn't read anything about it. I knew it had made the CBCA notable list. And before I picked it up, I didn't know much about it, but I just loved it from the first chapter. And I particularly enjoyed the significance of storytelling as an important motif in the novel. And Rhys says from the beginning, we all need stories. They help us understand our lives. How did writing The Tides Between help you understand life better?
That is a good question. It helped me on a number of levels. I suppose the thing is to just start with at the beginning. I really connected with my Welsh heritage during the writing of it. So I started out with an idea of, I had a bit of a midlife crisis, decided I'd always wanted to try and write a novel, and decided that, well, it would be historical because I love historical fiction. It would need to be Australian because I would need to be able to get the information fairly easily from local libraries. And I had been a migrant myself as a child, and so had always had a fascination with immigration, but didn't want to write about my own life. So I ended up starting with a biography of Carolyn Chisholm and kind of envisaged this emigration saga spanning 30 years with a group of characters coming to Australia. And you're probably sitting there thinking, well, you failed, because that really wasn't what I've written. And that's the truth. So I started out with that in mind and began to research immigration in the 19th century. And as I began to research, a character came into my mind who I called Bridie. And I had this sense that she'd lost her father in tragic circumstances, and that I wanted a creative young couple to be able to engage with her in terms of her grief. So those were the ideas that just came into my mind as I was reading about immigration. Initially I thought, oh, maybe they'll be Irish. But then I thought, well, gee, that's pretty cliche. And also, I was planning to go back to the UK for the first time. I'd turned 40 and I hadn't been back since childhood, and I had an opportunity to go back. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to stay with people, family. And I don't have any family in Ireland, but Mum was Welsh. I wonder if I could do something, make the young couple Welsh. So I didn't know anything about Wales, really, apart from rugby. They like rugby and male voice choirs. And rugby wasn't invented in the era I was writing in. And even if I could have sort of invented a scenario in which a whole male voice choir emigrated en masse, I didn't actually think that would be very inspiring to a 15-year-old girl. So I just began to do a little bit of research, and I found out that Wales had this incredible bardic culture, and I had known nothing about it. So I ordered books and read stories, and they sort of blew my mind a little bit, because my mum's Welsh, so they're my stories, mm-hmm. My heritage. And I hadn't even known that existed. I just fell in love them. I just adored them and engaged with them, and my Welsh couple became storytellers. The novel went through a number of drafts, so when I initially had them as storytellers, I really just had a couple of stories, and I really just used them to make a connection between Bridie and the couple. And I didn't do a great deal with them, but over subsequent drafts, I realised that if I wanted to have whole fairy tales in the novel, they needed to work hard They needed to earn their place in the narrative. So I set myself three goals for the stories Rhys tells. One, they had to be engaging, so they had to actually transport the reader so that they actually forgot they were reading a novel for a moment. Secondly, they had to teach characters something. The characters had to get something out of it. They had to contribute to their journey. And I also wanted them to mirror the plot as well. Mm-hmm. So that was how I developed the storytelling idea. And then out of these incredible conversations between Bridie and Rhys, I began to understand the application of stories in people's lives. I don't think I set out with that as a aim at the beginning. I discovered that. And Rhys would say these amazingly wise things, and I'd be thinking, wow, yes, that's what I believe. I really do believe that. That's the truth. And then he would come out with another one. And as I was engaging with him and Bridie and working through what the stories were teaching them, I suppose I was beginning to understand the role of stories in my own life. I don't think it's no accident that many of the world's religions are based on narratives, and even if we're not religious, movies, novels, even told stories by friends over the table, they help us sort of make sense of life. So I had that sense as I was writing it, that's what they do. But also that Bridie was a little bit disillusioned with her stories, and I suppose that sort of also mirrors my own sense of having to grapple with the stories that I've held dear in my life when they're challenged by difficult circumstances and to reinterpret them.
He says, you know, the stories, they shift and change as we learn to see differently. And I'm sure you yourself, when you read something when you were younger and you read it as you grow older, you can see it in a different light. So I really liked, you know, these ideas that particularly the character Rhys was coming up with. How did you develop his character? I mean, I know you said you wanted him to be Welsh and you wanted him to have a connection. And I read somewhere as well that you said you fell a bit in love with him, and I must admit, so did I.
Yeah.
So how did the development of Rhys come from? Because he was such a rich and complex character.
He was. And he just, I took a long time to write the novel, so he developed over time. I don't know if you've read that I actually ended up learning to speak Welsh.
I did. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. So I suppose in a way, through Rhys, I was exploring this incredible connection with culture that I had felt was, well, it was clearly absent from my life. And so in one sense, I was exploring through him the stories, the language, the culture of my forefathers. So I think that's why he became so rich and round, because he was part of that experience for me. It was like I was channeling all of that into him. He came on, he has a set of fears, and he has his own battles, and he sort of walked onto the ship with those. I don't know where they came from, but I knew what they were right from the outset. But I did learn to manipulate them more as the drafts, through the drafting process.
When I went backpacking a number of years ago, I met a Welsh girl, and I remember her just speaking in this language, and it was so intriguing and it sounded so challenging and difficult. How did you go about learning Welsh, and how difficult was it for you?
Well, I did Japanese in school and I was absolutely hopeless. I'm not a genius in terms of languages, and so I actually just came across Welsh classes in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I'd just go for a turn, because I'd read How Green Was My Valley, and I had realised that Welsh people spoke English differently. Even now in South Wales, where they don't all speak the language, they'll often construct sentences in different ways to how someone across the border will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually quite strongly linked to the language. So I had this sense that perhaps if I did a term or two of lessons, I might work out why they're doing that, why it is they sound a little bit different. So that's what I intended to do. I really didn't intend to learn the language. I didn't actually think I could learn a language. But what I did find was that I really enjoyed the classes and I really enjoyed the words. It has some amazing words, like, I'm just going to try and... So the Welsh word for owl is hudihu, which sounds like twitwu. And the Welsh word for butterfly is pilipala, which just sounds so delicate to me, like wings fluttering. And then the Welsh word for, well, corgi is a Welsh word, and it literally means wharf dog. But then the word for skunk is drelgi, which means stink dog. And then it has yuch goch gotta, which is little red cow for ladybird. So it's actually quite a sort of poetic and evocative language. And what I found was I just enjoy engaging with them. Every year we have, at the beginning of Welsh class, the first meeting of the year, because I still go, I'm now one of the tutors, and we all sit around and we talk about why we're learning Welsh, because we invariably have new people. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to introduce ourselves, say why we learn and how long we've been learning. And I can remember sitting there going, I'll never speak Welsh, but I just love the words, and so I'm just happy to be in their presence. But then we went through a very difficult time with our youngest daughter, and I wasn't actually able to do a great deal of writing, and I wasn't able to do a great deal of work. She worked her way through a list of every parent's worst fears, basically. So it sort of had a bad effect on my health. And at one stage, my husband said, why don't you just go away for a little while? You need a holiday. You know, you're always at home with her. Why don't you, we've got lots of frequent flyer points, why don't you just go? And so I decided to go to Wales. And in preparation for that, I came across an online Welsh course. And it's a sort of just an audio course, so it doesn't focus on grammar, because I'm really bad at learning language by grammar. It doesn't even focus on reading and writing. It just focused on getting you speaking and thinking in Welsh. But the thing about it was that the guy on the podcast was so kind. And every lesson he would say things like, you're doing a great job. Gee, you're doing well. Wow, you're amazing. And I swear, I just kept doing the course just to hear someone tell me I was doing a good job, because I felt like I'd a real failure at that point in my life. So I just clung. I say to people, I walked through that time clinging to the tail of an ancient language. And really, the course just probably because I was doing it so often, it just transformed my experience, and I found myself able to speak. So since then, I've just continued. I'm not fluent, although some people would kindly say I am. In my head, I'm not fluent, because I know I'm struggling for words at the time, but I'm very conversational.
Well, in terms of research, I think that went above and beyond, right? I think it's fantastic, and it's such an unusual language to learn when you're in Australia.
Yeah, well, it's true, but for me it's just about that, for the heart, and most of the people in our classes are there for the heart. We're a long way from home, I suppose, in one sense, and that's the way to have a connection.
Yeah, connection.
But it certainly just fueled my understanding of Rhys and Charm, and really just meant that I could just engage with them on a different level. And since I've written the novel, I've had one reviewer say, this book could not have been written by someone who had not learnt Welsh. And I think, well, that's good, because that's what I've done.
Yeah, and it was nice. It was different. Like you said, you know, if it had been an Irish person, I think we've all read about people from England and Ireland travelling to Australia. But this was really different, and that was something else that I really enjoyed about it, because it was something that you hadn't really read about before. So now, with your research, and it is historical fiction, obviously, so you needed to do quite a lot of research besides learning Welsh.
Yeah.
How do you go beyond the research and have characters think and act as someone from their time? Because you're not only trying to get the setting right, and, you know, like you said about getting the dates right and what was in fashion, like the rugby league, but then how do you get the characters in their what they'd be thinking at that point in time? Because that must be quite a challenge, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it limits things like metaphors and similes enormously, because obviously it has to be something that they know about. I suppose I've said to someone the other day, the reason I wrote historical fiction is actually I'm not very good at being modern. I've actually spent my life reading history and historical work and thinking about the past. I did a degree in history at university. So some of that is just my natural tendency. I don't think I'd write a very good novel set in the present. Then, of course, I read books. I read a lot of Dickens to just get a sense of the time and watched movies set in the Victorian era, read copious books about what people wore, what people ate, how people lived. And then the big thing, I think, was the shipboard diaries and things. There's quite a wealth of that sort of information available. Because it was in the Victorian era, it was quite well documented. And it was a government program, it was a government scheme. So there are shipboard diaries. I actually have a copy, just from Trove, of instructions for surgeons, superintendent on emigrant vessels. So all of the routines from the ship, the kinds of medicines they used, the way the ships were administered by the surgeon, I got from primary source documents from the 19th century. And there were also immigration tracts. So they would write booklets to entice people to emigrate. So you get a sense of what's meaningful to people or what people want in life by how they're trying to sell it to them or advertise it to them.
And it's about getting the details right as well. Like you said, you know, the ship's routine. You know, you wouldn't sort of think you'd need that when you're telling this, you know, great historical fiction, but in order to make it authentic, you need to know those kind of things.
It's true. And I got to, I said right at the beginning that I'd sort of set out to write a much longer saga. And I suppose you picked up that this book could continue. But I got to about the Bay of Biscay in the voyage and I started thinking, I think there might just be a story in this voyage. I had never written a novel before, and at that stage it really was just a practice novel. And I thought, well, why don't I just go with that and let's see, because it's just for practice. Mm-hmm. I'll just see if there's a story just in the voyage alone, which I believe there was. And then it's up to me, I guess, whether I go on.
I thought it was really interesting that the whole novel was set on the ship, you know, and I think that added to the kind of the stifling feeling of some of the characters, their vulnerability and the lack of freedom. So I thought that was really interesting, and I was trying to think of other books where they were just set in one place, and I struggled to think of many.
It's true. There are two that I know of. There was Slow Water, and I've forgotten the author's name, and Salt Letters by Christine Ballant, I think. So those two are shipboard diaries. They're very different. I suppose there are other shipboard narratives that are non-Australian. I sort of became aware of those quite early on. I read a lot of voyage diaries, I guess that's the thing. But yeah, so it was an unusual setting, and I wasn't sure about it, I suppose, in the sense that I set out as an experiment. But I think that in the end, what I aimed to do was to create the voyage became a symbol in itself. Mm-hmm. So as Bridie traversed the world's oceans, she was changing from a girl into a woman. And so she left home a girl and she arrived a woman. And then I was able to use the conditions like crossing the equator and the storms and also some of the illnesses to sort of feed into her journey and to sort of almost become symbolic. So I used, yes, so the voyage, I used the voyage in that way. It had quite a nice shape to it, I thought.
And as a reader, I felt it really added to the story because it made you feel like, you know, you couldn't get away from the horrors that occurred on the ship, you know, and you had to say, and it added to that tension and conflict, I think, because, you know, if something happens on land, you can just disappear or go home, but you can't, you're stuck with these people, you're stuck with the outbreaks that happen, and you are giving birth on a ship and that's it, you know, there's no one else to help you except the people on there. So I think it added to the fear and vulnerability, which I really liked, because I really like learning history through historical fiction, funnily enough, because I like the stories that go with it.
Yeah.
And so I really enjoyed that part of it. It made me terrified. Like, whenever I read these books, I'm like, oh, I'd love to live in that era, you know, to experience this different kind of time of the world. And then, you know, there's the typhus outbreak and how dangerous childbirth would be. And I'm like, oh, I don't know about that anymore.
No. It's nice to go there in novels.
Yeah, that's right.
It was a horrific journey. Mm. It really was. Before, it started in early 1850s, maybe 1851, around the time of the gold rush, they changed the journey, they changed the route. And they did a route called the Great Circle Route, which meant that they went right down into the Arctic regions, Antarctic region, and it made the journey shorter because, you know, the globe is, it's smaller, if you can get that concept. Mm-hmm. Instead of going straight across the biggest, roundest part, you go right down the bottom and scoot around. So it made the voyage a lot shorter, but it was brutal because then they went through the heat and then they went into this terrible cold, and it was really rough and cold. But in my era, they were still following the same route that they'd followed with the convicts and using some of the same old ships that they'd used with convicts. So it was a long, brutal journey between 3 and 5 months in length.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of the people on there probably never seen the sea before, and they certainly couldn't swim. Not that swimming would help you if you were wrecked at sea, but that sense of vulnerability of just being on water and I just think it would have been really awful. And then even when they left people, they left them forever, could write back, but it would take months for letters to get there, and not all of them could read or write. So it was an incredible wrench, I think, one that we perhaps can't even comprehend in this time.
You're right, that's what I was thinking as well, because once you're gone, you're not going back. You know, that's it.
Oh. Well, they had no money. Some of them may have got rich and been able to go back, and certainly that probably did happen. But for the most part, no, it was a one-way journey, and you said goodbye, and you never saw your family again.
The novel also deals with the power of magic. What can you tell us about Welsh magic and legends and why they feared it so much?
Wales has this strong bardic culture, so a lot of has the Mabinogion, which is a small fragments of an ancient body of mythology they believe, and then a lot of fairy tales and folk tales that have magical elements to them. I don't know if you've ever been, well, you have been to Wales. The landscape is incredibly mystical, so it's into that sense, and they have a lot of prophetic sort of poetry and stories, and a sense of themselves as the original Britons, and so Arthur is their myth originally, and they have that as strongly as part of the culture. Now, I doubt people those magic things today. However, I came across a manuscript written by a lady called Maya Trevelyan. And she had written about the folklore of the Welsh, and this was in the 18th or 19th century. So I read it all, and it would appear that even though there had been Methodist revivals, a lot of this sort of folklore and magic, beliefs in charms and colour lore and seeing signs in the weather, was all still part of the culture, according to this document. So as I was reading that, it was sort of feeding in, I guess, to my sense of recent charm, and I suppose their sense of otherworldliness, because I wanted the stories to feel like they were not just, to feel like they were working on the ship, that they were actually affecting what was happening on the ship, to give that sense of how stories do that in our lives in a way that's intangible. And so I suppose as I built their character, I drew on this sort of body of lore to try and build that otherworldliness in Rhys and Sean, to give them that sense of being different, and that their stories were working a kind of magic. I suppose I wanted to show that, and so I used a lot of that mythology and folklore to feed into that. I wanted to use the magic also to talk about hope and beliefs. Because I don't know whether you believe the magic worked. There is magic on the ship, but I think I leave it a little bit open as to whether it actually worked. Mm-hmm. But what I did show through it was the way it was changing the characters' lives, and I think that's kind of real magic. And I suppose I was trying to tap into that mysterious part of life that's intangible, and the way that can be changed inwardly by other things. So in terms of contrasting Sean's belief in magic with what Alf thought might have happened, with what Dr. Roberts thought might have happened, in some ways I'm exploring, well, I could be exploring any faith issue or any belief system in the world, because there will always be those kinds of reactions.
You know, after what happens on the ship, well, you kind of have to believe it, don't you? Whether you believe it or not, you have to have, you know, faith in it.
Yeah. I think so, and that's, I suppose that's, I said to someone, you know, when I was writing it, I realised that, so I've been a Christian since my teens, and I realised, and as I've grown older, I've had to grapple with what I believe still in the face of life, basically. Mm-hmm. And the stories that I once sort of read and thought, oh, yeah, okay, yep, I've had to grapple with and try and come to terms with whether I still believe them, how I read them with different eyes in light of what I've learned from life, in light of what I've learned about the complexity of life. And so what I realised I was doing was I was actually processing my own relationship with this body of literature that I've used as my faith formation, I suppose. And so when you see Bridie questioning and you see Reese talking about that, I realised, as I got towards the end of it, I thought, you know, I'm just writing about myself here. Grappling with the fact that some of the things that used to make sense don't anymore, but does that mean they're wrong? How do you read them? How do you be a person in the modern world, in a complex world, and yet still hold sacred things precious and dear and still feed from them? So I suppose I just really wrote about myself in the end. No, I never meant to.
Isn't that interesting? Because one of the first questions I asked you was, how did it help you understand your life?
Yeah,
That's a wonderful journey. And with magic comes personal secrets and pasts that haunt us, and they're really significant ideas in the novel. And as we've already established, Reese does say some very wise things, and he says, we all have secrets. We are all running, Tom, from poverty and disappointment, perhaps some of us from cruel expectations. And it's kind of a universal theme, isn't it? It doesn't matter hundreds of years later, it's still the same. Were these ideas always going to form an important basis for the novel?
No, it was my first novel, and as I said, it took me a long time to write, and so I learnt to write doing it. I hadn't written fiction since a terrible short story in year 11, so it was my university. The book was my university as a writer.
I like that.
And so I didn't really start it with a strong formed idea of what I wanted to say through the novel. That developed as I got to know my characters. But when Bridie says at the end, there were no easy answers, only life and people that were complex, I thought, that's probably what I think. And so I suppose I was, through her, I was exploring that sense of the greys, the non-blacks and whites, the greys of life, the really, really hard lessons. I mentioned my daughter earlier, we've lost her since I wrote the novel. And I learned a lot of those hard lessons through mothering her. So I was just exploring. I think I was just exploring my own journey, but through these characters. But I didn't set out to do that. I didn't think, okay, I'm going to explore my own journey through these characters. I just found myself writing myself into them, and writing my own questions into them, and then grappling for answers from them.
And I guess that gives the novel humanity and depth, and that's why readers connect with it, because, you know, everyone sort of experiences things like this, and I guess that's why it connects, yeah.
We all do have secrets. We all have areas in which we feel we've failed. We all have things we don't understand.
Mm.
And I think those, I guess, are the universal things that come through, even though the novel is deeply set in 1841, I think, you know, the other thing about Bridie is that she's lost a father, and that her parents' marriage was failing, and she was in a blended family, and she was trying to come to terms with that, which is also something that's just as current today as was then, maybe for different reasons.
And you talk about your book being a practice and, you know, the University of Writing, and yet your novel is a CBCA notable for 2018. Can you tell us about your publishing process and how you went from this is a practice novel to, hey, this is a notable book? It's quite an amazing journey.
Yeah, it was a long one, and I think I just, after I sort of got back into writing, I had the novel assessed. So I had it assessed twice, and I had to do a lot of rewriting. And at each point, people would say, well, you know, it needs work, but it's a good story, and you can write, you should keep going. And I suppose I grappled for a long time with whether I should move on, because I thought, no one spends so long on their first novel, and maybe I should just move on. But I had this sense that if I gave up, I would just reach this point with every novel and give up. And so that I just wanted to press through and finish it regardless of the outcome. Mm-hmm. So I had to sort of do that in the face of a great deal of self-doubt. And even about a year or two prior to it being finished, I began to realise it was a very unusual novel in the sense that it's officially a young adult novel, but it has a stepfather's viewpoint, which I don't think is very common. I'm a children's librarian, or I was a young adult librarian, and I don't think there are many historical novels doing that well, let alone ones with a stepfather's point of view, let alone one sits on a whole ship, set on a ship.
Yeah.
And so I thought, this may never get published, this novel, but I need to finish it. And I actually went to live in Wales for 7 months, and I finished it in Wales. And I sat there and I thought, this may never get finished, but here I am sitting in the land of my fathers, I'm speaking the language, and I just feel deeply happy with the journey I've come on. So I thought, it doesn't matter. It actually doesn't matter. This novel's done its work. However, I wasn't so foolish as to not try. I thought, well, I'm going to have to give it a go. I'm going to have to give pitching this novel a go. I did a ASA Meet the Author sort of speed dating program and pitched it to a number of the larger publishers, but didn't get any response. And a friend of mine, a mentor, said, why don't you just go on the small press network and have a look through there? And I had quite a lot of interest from small presses, and in the end signed with Odyssey, which is one of the small presses. And it's you know, when you sign with a small press, that you're going to have to do a lot of your own marketing, and that, you know, it's probably not going to be an international bestseller. But it didn't matter, because to me it was just that it was going to be published. The story I'd worked on for so long, someone was going to read it, and maybe someone was going to enjoy it. And I'd gone on this amazing journey of inner growth as I wrote it. So that was how it happened. It got picked up by Odyssey Books. And I wasn't sure. Well, I just entered it in the CBCA Awards, because you just do, don't you? You think, well, I've written the book, I may as well enter it in a few prizes. And then I'd forgotten, actually, and we lost our daughter. We lost our daughter earlier this year, so it's been a really difficult year. And I was just in Welsh class, because I'd gone back to Welsh pretty early because there aren't a lot of teachers. And I was sitting in Welsh class, and my phone just started beeping. And I thought, and I ignored the first, then the second. And then finally I just said to my class, look, I'm sorry, I might have to answer this. A lot had been happening in our family, and I thought I can't ignore this. And it was all my writing group and friends texting me to say I was in the notable list. And, you know, I was sort of, my daughter had died that month. You know, she died that month. And I just sat there and I just said to someone, I just don't know if I need this at the moment. And this person just looked at me and she said, it's exactly what you need. And I'm still not sure it was, because I lost all my peace. You know, I was hopeless in the month leading up to the shortlist, and then when I didn't get shortlisted, I felt like crushed. It would have been much better to be in complete ignorance. However, it's just been amazing. It was just a lovely affirmation, I suppose, to know that the book was okay, because I really still wasn't sure. I still wasn't sure whether it was any good, even though I got it picked up by a publisher and some people had said some nice things about it. I suppose that sort of sunk in, oh, okay, maybe I can write.
And what a roller coaster of a year it has been for you.
Yeah, so that it was amazing, and I wanted to try and see whether a few teacher friends said to me, it's a very teachable book, maybe you should try and see if some schools would like to study it. And I suggested this to my husband, and it was going to cost a bit of money to get a study guide made, and we were sort of umming and ahhing, and then we got the notable listing, and I thought, oh, I'll just do it, I'll get a study guide made. So we've invested in a study guide, and we're hoping to do some mailing out to schools and see whether it could even be a teachable text.
Now, there was a beautiful twist at the end, and it was open for a sequel, as you mentioned before. I would love to see a sequel. What's next for you? Are you going to work on something different, or you're having a break, or you think there might be more to the story for Bridie and Reese and the rest of the people?
Well, there definitely is. I know how it ends. It's three books. And I had had to summon so much faith to finish this one that I thought, no, I think I'm going to just do an in-between project and we'll see what happens. And then when it did get picked up, I thought to myself, should I be dropping the in-between project now? And then I thought, I'm really into this, so I'm just going to go with it. And then I can always return. So when I was living in Wales, it's going to be set in medieval Wales, so it's been quite a steep learning curve. But there's a man called a 14th century nobleman called Owen Glyndwr. He's actually in Shakespeare's Henry IV. Mm-hmm. And he is, there are statues of him all over Wales. So he was the last native Welshman to hold the title of Prince of Wales. And for about 9 years under him, Wales was independent. But the thing is, he had a wife. I was reading this book about him. Most of the historians have been men, and they write all about Owain's battles and Owain's journey and poor Owain at the end. And his wife went to the Tower of London as a consequence of his revolt with her daughter and her granddaughters. And to all intents and purposes, we believe she died there. So I was reading about Owain and all these sort of historians talking about poor Owain, this. And I'm thinking, forget Owain, what about the wife? She was supposed to have a lot of children. They all end up dead. Mm-hmm. So I thought it would be really interesting to subvert the male narrative by telling it from a female perspective. And so I'm going to try and, well, I've started writing a novel from the point of view of Owen Glyndwr's wife. And I'm just in the first draft stages at the moment because it's taken a lot of research. And I'm really hoping it won't take as long as the last book, because otherwise everybody will have forgotten about my first book. I think it's a matter of just turning up at the page each day and doing what needs to be done. You write whole chapters and you think, guess what, that's not going to be part of the book, but I had to write it to find that out. It's a very, very messy process, I find, but I don't know. Some people are amazing plotters, but I'm just not, just don't seem to be one of them. So I know how the story ends, and I know what I want to show through it, but I'm just working out how to get there.
It's interesting you say that. I spoke to Kate Forsyth not too long ago, and she was saying the same thing about the forgotten women in history and how she was giving voices to them, and her new novel, Beauty and Thorn. So I really like the idea of, you know, the forgotten women in history and giving them that voice, because they were, you know, an important part of our history as well.
I actually listened to that podcast and I really enjoyed it, and I know Kate. And yes, it's something that I think we're becoming more aware of, is that so many stories in history have been written from the point of view of a man or a male perspective. Mm. And there was this woman who, even in Wales, which is very conscious of its own history, I talked to them and I've spoken to people and I've said, so do you know the name of Owen Glyndwr's wife? And they just look at you blankly. And you think, wow, you know, if I had a dollar for every statue or thing named after the guy in Wales, I'd be a rich woman. But there's nothing about his wife.
Yeah, there's such important stories to tell, so I'm glad they're being told.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be pure fiction because very little is known about her. And in fairness to historians, that's probably why there isn't a history book about her, because there really is so little known. Mm-hmm. But that gives you a great deal of freedom to just reinterpret. Yeah, and just to imagine what would it have been like, maybe.
Well, I look forward to it. And thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. I really adored the novel. And I look forward to finding out what happens and your in-between project as well. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.